From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
I wanted to understand what is going on in the economy, in the United States, in the world. Are we in a massive crisis like some people suggest? Are we doing okay? Did the Fed raise interest rates too much? What's going on with the US dollar and oil? What's going on with unemployment? Are we going to enter a recession? And of course, no one has all the answers. And I've done a lot of reading on this, and you, the listeners, and I have already had these discussions a little bit. But I brought on a guy who is definitely one of the, he might not consider himself this, but he's definitely one of the experts in the world. He's David Rubenstein, been on the podcast several times before, runs the Carlyle Group, which is one of the biggest private equity funds on the planet. I mean, manages about $500 billion. So he sees where the economy is going. He's got $500 billion worth of investments, which means, you know, trillions of dollars worth of businesses overall that he's involved in, and that he's got his finger on the pulse of, and he's been in and involved with the economy and the political system since the 70s. So there was no better person to call and say, what is going on? And David was nice enough to come on and answer all the questions I had. So here's David Rubenstein.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
So, David, I really wanted to just ask you about your opinions on the economy. Just from my own perspective, everything seems to me, with my limited experience, more unpredictable than I've ever seen it before. This time, things are different in terms of the circumstances that led up to this. You've said that the Fed might raise their inflation rates. You've been at times optimistic, at times pessimistic. Like, what's your overall feeling?
My general view is that the Federal Reserve is being very cautious, as you saw from Jay Powell's most recent statement in Grand Teton's retreat in Jackson Hole. I think that he's very afraid of being seen as too dovish and saying, well, we've conquered inflation. It's down to 3% or so, and we can definitely next year reduce interest rates. He made it clear that we're not out of the woods yet, and therefore the market is assuming that chance of another 25 basis point increase this year is reasonably good, though it's not guaranteed. The Fed does not want to be in the embarrassing position of saying inflation has gone down, we can begin lowering interest rates, and then they have to backtrack. That's the last thing they want to do. It destroys their credibility. So their credibility is premised on basically taking us in the direction that they said they're going to get us to, and that is 2% inflation rate. I think that's very difficult to do, but certainly we're not there yet. So I would expect that probably another 25 basis point increase at some point this year, and probably not a lowering, at least until we're past the first two quarters of next year.
Well, you know, I'm curious because before the pandemic, or right around the time of the pandemic, like March 2020, the Fed's biggest concern was deflation. They couldn't seem to lower interest rates enough. And so at some point they decided, hey, we don't need to be at 2%. We need to be around there. We're going to overshoot a little to try to get inflation rather than deflation. And then, of course, they overshot too much. Could it be that they're overshooting too much on the downside, given that we really don't know the actual future effects of the recent rate hikes?
Well, of course, as the Japanese and others have learned over the years, getting out of deflation is much more complicated than getting out of inflation. I think the Fed did not want to increase interest rates at this level to get some inflation into the system. I think the COVID basically scared the policymakers in the Trump administration and in the Biden administration into taking action because they thought the economy would be so slow and so low that they had to inject enormous amounts of liquidity into the market. They did so thinking it would be transitory, and then it turned out it wasn't transitory. So then they had to live with the consequences of injecting so much money through, you know, various programs into the economy. So at the moment, as we talk today, I'd say there's always no complete consensus in Washington, but I'd say a reasonable consensus is that we may have dodged a bullet on a hard landing. Now, there are some people who say a hard landing is inevitable and that when every time you increase interest rates as high as they have done here, you ultimately get a so-called hard landing or a recession. But at the moment, we don't seem to be going in that direction because the unemployment rate is very low. The GDP is holding up. We don't see evidence of massive concern about the ability of the consumers to be willing to spend money. And so as a result of this, you're probably going to have GDP this year at somewhere around 1.5, 1.7%, which is better than you would get if you were going to get into a hard landing. I interviewed a person recently named Jeremy Grantham, who you probably know.
Yes.
He's a fairly bearish person. Generally, he's always looking for, bubbles. And he did tell me in the interview I did with him that he thinks we still will have a recession at some point as a result of all the increases in interest rates. But most people would say right now, the consensus so-called, is that we may have dodged a recession or a so-called hard landing, but it's still a little early to tell.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because unemployment is at historic lows. Could it be the case that people are just completely leaving the workforce? They're either retiring if they're older or they're doing more freelance and kind of what you call it, side hustle job type jobs as opposed to participating in the workforce?
There's three things that people should think about. First, the unemployment rate appears to be very, very low in light of how high interest rates are going. Typically, if you increase interest rates, you get unemployment to go up as employers stop hiring. The reason it probably hasn't happened here are three reasons, I think. One is that a lot of people dropped out of the workforce when COVID came. Older people, 55 and older, basically, they stayed home and then they didn't want to go back to the office and they ultimately retired. Younger people went back to school or started living with their parents and they haven't really rejoined the labor force. So as you know, we usually have about 66% of adult males and females in the labor force, and now we've got about 62%. So we have a smaller percentage of theoretically eligible workers in the workforce. Second, we don't have a lot of immigration going on right now. So let me put it in this terms. For a population to stay the same, a population needs to have women of childbearing age have 2.1 children on average when they're in their fertile years. Our population, and women in the United States are reproducing at 1.6 children per woman of fertile age. So we're reproducing at a lower rate than we would just to keep the population the same. And we're not letting immigration come in very much. And so immigration is, it's been thwarted under the Trump administration and the Biden administration. You don't have a lot of legal immigration. And as a result, a lot of the jobs that would normally be filled by immigrants, jobs at restaurants, service stations, pharmacies and things like that, drugstores, food stores, you don't see those jobs being filled so much by new immigrants anymore because the new immigrants aren't here. And that's another factor. A third factor is that you have to remember what the unemployment rate really is. It's a compilation of how many people look for a job in the last 30 days. And so the data may not be completely accurate, but I know from my own experience in business now, it's very hard to get employees at certainly the lower economic levels of compensation to come to work and to hire these people. So a lot of factors are going on that probably make it unlikely that we're going to have high unemployment anytime soon.
Right. So I don't know if I really count those numbers in some sense in terms of whether we're going to be in a recession or not. I mean, well, another way to look at it is with interest rates having moved up so fast, the cost to buy a home for a middle-income family that requires a mortgage has basically doubled.
Yes, dramatically higher. And as a result of that, developers, to the extent there are still real estate developers who are have money left, what they're really doing is building rental housing and apartments, not so much houses for sale, because it's easier now to get people to rent something because people are having a hard time getting mortgages. And right now, people who have mortgages and want to sell their houses and move elsewhere are having a hard time doing so because they can't find the many buyers out there that can get a mortgage. And also, these people can't really easily get new mortgages themselves at the rates that they could that they would have to pay today if they were to buy a new house. So the housing market is very, very slow and very inactive at the moment. The rental market is where you're seeing much more real estate activity.
Right, but the housing industry and building homes is a huge part of the economy.
It has historically been, and that's why people are worried about whether we're going to go into some kind of, quote, recession, in part because real estate often leads you into a recession. And one of the things we haven't yet seen really good data on is how bad is the urban office market? For example, in large cities, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, you have very high rates of people not coming to work. In other words, they don't come to work. They work at home 5 days a week or 3 days a week or whatever it is. Employers have had a hard time getting employees to come back to work. And it may well be that we're at the beginning of a 4 day or 3 day in the office work week that's permanent. And if that's true, then what you're going to see is that fewer leases are going to be renewed at the space that people had because they're going to need less space. And they're going to also be able to try to get them at lower rents. So you're going to have a very big distressed real estate debt market soon because the debt on major office buildings in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Houston, they're going to have very high default rates, let's say, and they're already beginning to have default rates. And the banks don't really want to take back the debt at this point, but at some point they may be forced to do so.
And so what will happen then? I mean, when all these commercial real estate investors and developers
right.
start going bankrupt and the banks don't want the bill. I mean, in San Francisco, they're literally just handing over the keys and saying,
right.
you take it now, we can't deal with this.
Well, typically what you do is you can't service the debt. You go into you're foreclosed by the bank. The bank takes it back, and then they ultimately sell it probably at a 15%, maybe 20% discount to what they had carried it for. Today, one of the reasons the banks don't want to take the debt back and they're not rushing to take it back is the discount would be 35 or 40%, if not 50%, and therefore they would have to reflect that on their balance sheets, whereas right now they might be marking it down by 10 or 15 or 20%, not fully to where the market would take it. So the banks are not dying to take these buildings back right now, but at some point they probably will. At some point, the regulators will say, you've got to recognize the real value of the mortgage. It's a big problem for banks and it's a big problem for the real estate developers.
I mean, one of the things that happened in 2007, 2008 is that banks started to realize the potential losses from the, you know, personal real estate market. And that's what, you know, all these banks then went out of business, all these derivatives collapsed. Could something similar happen in commercial real estate?
Well, it could. I'd say when the government, the major banks in the United States have more real estate on their books than they really want, but it's not easy to dispose of it. At some point, I suspect you'll see a market in distressed debt in real estate in commercial buildings that hasn't yet happened yet in any major way. In terms of being analogous to what's happened before, it's possible. I don't know. When the S&L crisis happened in the late 80s, that was a situation where you had so much real estate that the government, in fact, had to take it over and ultimately sold it. It turns out probably at lower prices than they probably should have. In 07, 08, you saw a lot of people buying back debt at discounts and they made money in the end. Right now, though, we're talking about debt that discounts that are so much higher than what we saw in 07, 08 that it's not quite clear what's going to happen. It's one thing to say that debt is worth 85% of what it once was, but to say it's worth 50% is another factor. And the reason it's so much lower in terms of the value is this. One, interest rates are higher. So when interest rates go up, by almost by definition, the value of a building goes down. And secondly, people are coming back to work, as I noted earlier, at a lower levels, and therefore you don't need as much office space. So when people are going to renew leases, they're not going to renew them at the same space that they probably had before.
Right. So is this kind of a problem that we're closing our eyes to, or is there going to be potential solutions?
Well, people are not closing their eyes to it, but I'd say it's not yet on the front pages of the newspapers as a crisis, because you have a lot of people, you know, are have other problems to worry about. But I think in the real estate community, if you talk to people in the real estate community, they see this as the potentially one of the bigger crises they've ever seen in commercial real estate.
Right. And so what could happen in, like, compared to 2007, 2008 and the economy almost collapsed? However, the Fed under Bernanke developed a playbook, which is get more involved early.
Well, we'll have to see where we are when the crisis hits. It's not likely to hit in a dramatic way for another 1 or 2 years, because it's going to take a while for this to play through the system. At that point, the interest rates may be lower, and therefore the problem may be ameliorated by lower interest rates to some extent. But I think the biggest factor overall is that fewer people are going to work in offices than before 5 days a week. Now, some of the financial service firms in New York are telling their people they have to come back 5 days a week. And some other employers, Amazon recently said, we want you back 5 days a week. But getting employees to come back 5 days a week in a very tight labor market isn't often that easy to do, because employees can go elsewhere.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like, in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like, the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, good things come to those who wait. I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle. Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So could this lead to a potential deflation if banks start suffering, perhaps lending less, commercial real estate starts, you know, trading all distressed debt? And a lot of those employees you mentioned aren't necessarily going back to office buildings. A lot of the Amazon employees are going back to warehouses, for instance, where real estate's not really in a crisis.
I would say historically, the United States hasn't struggled with deflation that much in recent years because it's been a reasonably dynamic economy. Japan had a very bad decade or so of deflation because the economy wasn't growing very much and wasn't a lot of entrepreneurial activity. I think in the United States, deflation is not one of our 1, 2, 3, or 4, 5 biggest problems we have to worry about right now.
Right. Although before COVID hit, I mean, that was what the Fed was worrying about because they couldn't really inflate things.
But that's different. I mean, the world's changed. And so as a result of having inflation hit as high as 9%, now it's probably at a core rate of maybe 3.5 or 4%, so-called core inflation. But that's deflation, not something we have to worry about today.
And does it worry you on the inflationary side, the BRICS countries considering currencies other than the U.S. for purchasing dollars? I mean, purchasing oil?
That is a potentially serious problem for the United States in this sense. We are the only reserve currency in the world. We don't have a sovereign wealth fund, unlike many other countries, but we have the printing press. And we can print as many dollars as people are willing to buy. And for the last 50 years or so, we've been the only reserve currency and people have been willing to buy our dollars. They've been willing to buy it so easily from us that we've run up about $32.7 trillion of debt. So how can you run up that much debt? Well, you run it up because people are willing to buy your dollars. If the dollar goes down in value, in part because there is another reserve currency, yes, we surely will have a problem. I don't see that in the near term. I don't see any currency really competing against the dollar in a serious way in the near term. But, 10 years from today may be different. But in the next 5 years or so, the dollar is likely to be the only reserve currency.
Yeah, is it fair to say, like for instance, a few weekends ago, India bought oil in rupees. But is it fair to say that Saudi Arabia and other countries don't really want to hold rupees that much compared to the dollar?
I think that's an understatement. Yes, that's true. Look, India has been buying a lot of oil, and I think China has as well, at discount rates from Russia, and if buying them in, sometimes they've been buying them in rubles, but if buying them in 20% discounts, what they're doing is the oil ultimately is being refined in the United States or elsewhere and sold back to the United States or in Europe at the market rate. So, for India and China, the Russia need to find markets has really made it profitable for a lot of people in the oil business in India and China.
But in terms of them replacing the dollar as kind of the reserve currency to buy oil with, you don't think that's happening?
Well, in the reserve currency world, to be a reserve currency, you have to have enormous amount of public disclosure. And that's one of the reasons the Chinese have said for many years, they don't really see the need to make the RMB a reserve currency. Mm. They don't want to disclose all the kind of things you have to do if you're a reserve currency. People might from time to time buy oil in other currencies, but I suspect they will quickly convert it into dollars as soon as they can.
Mm. On the optimistic side, the one thing it seems in each case of a recession that the U.S. always has going for it is that we innovate new industries out of nothing. And so, the internet, biotech, genomics, right now AI. Does this give hope for, the increases in productivity that each one of these new industries gives us? Does that give you hope that we can sort of weather any sort of crisis, economic crisis?
Well, the United States, you're correct, has found many new ways to innovate and make our economy more productive. AI will probably be a quantum leap in productivity when it's fully implemented in many ways. I don't worry about the U.S. economy in that respect. I think the United States economy will innovate sufficiently to overcome some of these challenges, but there's always a difficult transition period of time. And some people will lose their jobs. Other people will get jobs they wouldn't have otherwise had. So the transition is always difficult. In China, one of the curses that people give to other people is to say, may you be condemned to live in a time of transition. because transitions are so difficult at times, and it will be for workers in the United States and many people who have to transition and learn new job skills.
Right. So the U.S., by innovating in productivity, is essentially, maybe it doesn't need as large a workforce, or maybe it doesn't need the inflation that usually comes when you don't have these increases in productivity. I'm just trying to think if the innovation itself is replacing what typically lower interest rates or higher money supply would do.
Well, innovation is no doubt a factor that can overcome some other challenges they'll have in the economy. In the United States has been the leader in entrepreneurial activity for sure. But, you know, it's just hard to tell if during a transition period of time who's going to benefit and how much the United States will benefit. As Warren Buffett likes to say, nobody's really made any money over the last 100 years or so betting against the United States economy. When you tend to bet against the United States economy, you tend to lose. Now, there's no guarantee the United States economy will be the biggest in the world in our lifetime, and probably China will surpass us at some point. But I think the United States economy is still in reasonably good shape and likely for the next 25 to 50 years to still be a dynamic, large economy, one of the most important, if not the most important in the world.
What about the debt? Like you mentioned the $32 trillion in debt. Like when does, for my entire life, I feel like people have been saying the debt is a problem, the national debt is a problem, but it never really has been a problem. So what is the issue? What could be a problem?
Okay. There are five ways to solve this problem. Number one, you increase taxes. Well, that's very unpopular. Number two, you cut spending, even more unpopular, particularly because 85% of the budget is defense spending, entitlements, and so forth. So it's very hard to cut and interest. Number three, you can go to the IMF and say, we need a bailout. Well, obviously, we're too big for that. Four, you can say, look, whoops, we're sorry, we borrowed too much. We default. Obviously, you can't do that either. So there's only one alternative, and that's to do what we're now doing, in effect, inflate your way out of it. The only way out of this is for your children and my grandchildren and so forth to be paying this debt off 20 years down the road at inflated dollars. That's the only solution. The United States has had debt since it started. The country started. We had about $70 million of post-Revolutionary War debt that we had to pay off. During the Clinton years, we had 3 years of surplus. And for your listeners, a surplus is when you take in more money than you actually spend. Many people in my children's generation don't know what that is because they haven't seen a surplus. But a surplus did actually exist a couple times in the 1990s. But I don't think we're going to have that anytime soon again. We're running about a $1.7 trillion annual deficit now. To a 1.6, 1.7, yeah, trillion annual deficit. And, you know, we ran up, I think under President Obama, who was in 8 years, we ran up about, I would say, I think it was roughly $8 trillion of additional debt. Under President Trump in 4 years, about $9 trillion of additional debt. It's so in this century, we've run up enormous amounts of debt under President George W. Bush as well. And I don't think we're going to pay that off anytime soon. But the reason it's people talk about it and don't do anything about it is because the bond markets are still willing to sell U.S. debt because it has an advantage. It's a large amount of money. And when you buy these treasury bills, you know you're going to be paid back. You don't have to worry that the dollar is going to be deflated or devalued in very many ways. And you know the U.S. government is going to pay it back. Well, why don't you go buy Argentina's debt or go buy Brazil's debt or go buy many other countries' debt? Because you're not sure they're going to be able to pay it back. What about Japan? Japan can pay its debt back. So why are people moving the Japanese debt as a substitute? Because their economy isn't big enough to sell enough or need to sell enough treasury bills. One of the advantages that our economy has, quote, advantages, is that we borrow so much money. We have so many treasury bills out there that if you're China or you're Saudi Arabia or Japan and you need to park lots of money and get a reasonable interest rate, get your money back, you know, U.S. dollars is about the only game in town.
You know, you mentioned that the fifth way of getting out of inflation was to, out of this debt is to inflate our way out of it. Again, could innovation be a sixth way in the sense that, okay, you can't raise taxes, but you can collect more taxes if your industries are exporting enough to the rest of the world because they're new and they're great?
Well, let me put it this way. Under President Biden, I think one of the early bills that was passed was a bill to get, I think it's maybe 80,000 more IRS agents or employees. The theory is that you have more IRS agents and employees, you collect more taxes. But that's now, you know, very subject to criticism, and the Republicans are very much against that. And so, sure, you can always collect more taxes, and there's a lot of more taxes that can be collected legally and without raising tax rates. But there's a big resistance in Washington, D.C., in certain political circles, to increasing the ability of the IRS to get more money back.
But not just by collecting more taxes that currently exist, but by creating industries that just make more money. So more revenues are generated, so more taxes are collected.
Well, sure. Of course, that's always a good way to do it. It just takes a while for it to happen. So take artificial intelligence. You know, is it really going to produce a lot more tax revenue in the near future? Hard to know. Because in this country, we tend to defer taxation when things increase in value, but there's no liquefaction event. So if you invest in the leading artificial intelligence company in the world, and and you just hold on to the stock, and sell it, then there's no big increase in taxes.
Right, but the company itself will generate revenues and profits and export yes. technology to other countries and so on.
That's true, and it's a good thing. But remember, if you look at the tax bills being paid by some of the largest companies in the United States, they don't seem to be paying as high a rate as you might think.
We also have some of these exponentially growing industries like genomics, where it's small now compared to the rest of the healthcare industry, but for all we know, in 5 years, 10 years, it could be curing every disease.
Oh, sure. It could be. I mean, when I worked in the White House in the late 1970s, healthcare was 7% of the U.S. GDP. Now it's 22%, and it's growing. And it's growing because not only of new things like genomics and other kinds of incredible marvels, biotech and other things, but you find that people are living longer. In 1934, when the Social Security Act was passed, the average life expectancy was 65. In 1900, the average life expectancy in the United States was 49. Now, you know, if you're white in a reasonably prosperous area, you're likely to live, you know, to in your early 80s or if not longer.
And, could this aging population and higher rates of retirement, could this make the bill come due earlier in terms of entitlements, like on Social Security and Medicare?
Oh, it's already coming due. For example, in 1934, the average life expectancy, as I mentioned, was roughly 65, and you could retire and collect your Social Security benefits when you were 65. So most people didn't live that long after they were starting to collect benefits. Now, if the average, life expectancy of certain sectors of the economy is 82, 83, 84, you're taxing people at an insufficient rate to really pay for all that. We have what we call in this country a Social Security system that's called pay as you go, which means that when you get your get your payroll check every week or every other week, there's a deduction for FICA, Social Security. Well, that's going to pay your grandmother's Social Security needs or benefits right away. In Canada or Australia, they have different systems there where they actually have real money that is designed to be available to pay the benefits that are due to people when they retire. We don't have that. It's a big problem in our country, but we're not going to solve that anytime soon.
Right. So that could lead to more debt or more printing or whatever you call it. And that's a problem, because eventually the debt comes due or it doesn't, because it seems like this has always been a problem.
Kick it down the road was basically our model for a long time. What they did in Canada about 20 years ago or so, they started a system where they actually had money set aside from, I guess, tax revenues and then from employer contributions and employee contributions. And they have a dedicated fund that's now very, very large that's available to pay the pensions that are due. But we don't have that. We just, it's, as I say, it's pay as you go.
Just in and so good. Thousands of summer deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save up to 60% on new arrivals from Vince, Rag & Bone, Adidas, Joe's, Marc Jacobs, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. But hurry for first dibs. Get your summer favorites up to 60% off at Nordstrom Rack today. Great brands, great prices. That's why you rack.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
I wonder, and I know solutions like this have been bandied about, but I wonder if a federal national sales tax on the one side and a lower flat tax on the income side would raise the money. Because a flat tax on the income side would make it simpler for people to pay, particularly if it's lower. And a federal sales tax allows you to kind of tax almost visibly.
First, the states which get a lot of their money off of sales taxes don't want a federal sales tax, because that would, you know, basically mean it would cut into probably the revenue that they're going to get. Secondly, sales taxes are seen as regressive, which is to say wealthy people, the sales tax doesn't mean as much, but the poor people, it's a bigger problem. And also flat taxes are seen as, the Democratic Party as basically a giveaway to wealthier people, because you want the wealthier people to pay a higher rate. And if you're paying a flat tax, it's going to be the same for everybody. So the result is going to be, you're going to probably, in the view of many Democrats, you're going to basically let wealthy people pay less taxes and you probably won't collect as much revenue. But, you know, some presidential candidates have tried that as a part of their platform when they run, and it doesn't get very far.
I wonder why, because the math probably does add up to more money collected. Because more people would pay. It would be simpler to pay. More people would simply pay.
Yes, but if you say, should Bill Gates be paying the same rate as the guy working in the post office, most people would say probably not. But that's what a flat tax does. Everybody pays the same rate. Now, obviously, some people have more income. But there's a general sense in our country for many years now that progressive taxation is a good thing. And as a result, you have higher rates on wealthier people. I think it's very difficult to get Congress to change that.
Yeah. So on the one hand, we have real problems. And on the other hand, there are people for political purposes sort of avoiding solving all the problems. And it seems like the only thing that could really help solve the problems that you outlined, or the five solutions that you outlined, is innovation. And I don't know how you... What's the...
Innovation helps for sure. But in the end, we basically have a social net for people in this country, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, that is a gigantic part of the budget, and we don't have the growth rates in our economy to really justify everything today. And therefore, that's why we have a kick it down the road approach, which is to say, we'll borrow more money. So we can borrow more money for foreseeable future, and until the markets won't buy the debt anymore, we can keep doing this. But, you know, I don't know if it can continue forever.
So what happens then?
Well, if you read books about this, generally what happens is, and Ray Dalio wrote a very good book about this not long ago, basically saying, in effect, that throughout history, countries which have the only reserve currency, such as the guilder that the Dutch had, or the sterling or pound that the British had, ultimately they take advantage of it by selling so much debt, because it's the reserve currency and people want to buy it, that they borrow too much. And they borrow too much, ultimately, you have high inflation and the value of their reserve currency goes down and people don't want it anymore. So at some point, if we keep borrowing at the rate we have, at some point, I don't know when, it may not be in my lifetime, but we will not be the only reserve currency, or we will have a situation where people just won't want to buy the dollars because they're not worth as much as they thought they were when they were buying them.
And this does, on the one hand, the way you describe it, it does seem like a catastrophe. On the other hand, England and Japan both have survived or let's take a look at England in particular. They survived not being the world's number one economy. I mean, they were for a long time and now they're not, but they're doing pretty good.
Okay. I mean, United Kingdom now is roughly 3% of the world's GDP. We are roughly 18 or 19%, something like that. So we're a much bigger economy. The UK amazingly controlled the world for many years. They with 20,000 soldiers in India, they controlled India. They had a fleet that basically was the largest fleet in the world. So, you know, if you live in London now, you don't have the kind of per capita net worth and wealth that you had 100 years ago, in effect. But people seem to be, as you suggest, doing okay. The United States is used to being the biggest economy in the world. We've been the biggest economy in the world since 1870. And we probably will be by GDP for another 20 years or so, 25 years. China is bigger than we are now by purchase price parity measurements. But still, you know, it's something that I'm not as worried about as you probably are, because I'm older than you and I'm not going to live to see the problems.
you're kicking the can to me and my kids.
Well, my kids too, and my grandchildren, they're going to deal with it, but I'll be watching from somewhere, I hope.
And David, what are you currently working on? Is there another book on the horizon?
Yes, I'm working on a book on the American presidency. I've done a lot of interviews with people who have been presidents of the United States or people that have studied the presidents of the United States, and I have my own views on it. So that'll come out, I hope, next year.
And what's the idea of the book?
Well, the theme is that it's the most important job in the world, and maybe we can find better ways to either elect this person or to deal with some of the consequences of not allowing the system to work as way the founding fathers wanted it to work. But you know, it's no perfect easy answer.
Like in terms of elections, how come they've never adopted the internet or some form of secure internet to make votes? This way we don't have any of these issues that we see popping up in every election.
Well, because the internet is very subject to hacking. And so, you're going to give the Russians or the Chinese or North Koreans complete access to our election system if you do that. You know, the thing that's most interesting is to me is when this country was started, we had in 1776, we had 3 million people in it, 3 million people. A half a million of those 3 million were slaves, and they couldn't be in government. And 1.25 million of the remaining people who were white were women, and they couldn't be in government. And then if you were Jewish, you couldn't be in government either. And then you had about 500,000 people who didn't own any property. So you have about 500,000 white Christian property-owning men who could participate in government. Out of those 500,000, you got George Washington, John Adams, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin, among others. Now we have 330 million people. And what do we have? Well, we don't see a lot of George Washingtons and Thomas Jeffersons, do we? So where are all the great people? Well, my theory is they all went into private equity.
Which conveniently is where you are. Well, and you went from politics into private equity.
Right. But I mean, to be very serious, I wish it would be good if we could get people to come into the political world who haven't been professional politicians or people, you know, who seem to be more attentive to some of the real issues we have to deal with.
But now there's so much money involved to elect a president that everybody has to cater to special interests. Alexander Hamilton didn't have to cater to any special interests. George Washington had no special interests.
Yes. In the last campaign, Biden versus Trump, roughly on the entire election, for everybody counting all the dollars, almost $6 billion was spent.
Right. That's why you have to be skilled at other things than statesmanship and governing in order to win. You have to know how to raise money.
You have to do much. It's different. I mean, over the weekend, I interviewed a candidate who's running for president who's very different. I don't support candidates one where I stay out of politics, but I interviewed him. His name is Vivek
Ramaswamy. So he's a case where he's not coming from a political background, and some people are supportive of that. Some people are critical of that. But what did you think overall? He's a very, very smart guy.
Well, I would say, clearly getting people not from a political background may have pluses. You know, there are a lot of talented people who aren't in political backgrounds. He is young. He's only 38 and has not served in government at all. But he's obviously very articulate and, as I pointed out to him, doesn't lack in self-confidence or self-assurance.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting in a couple elections, in the next few elections. And I really look forward to this next book. When's it coming out?
Sometime, I hope, in the spring.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to talking to you about it then. And thank you so much, David, for joining us on the podcast. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Good luck.
Justin, and so good. Thousands of summer deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save up to 60% on new arrivals from Vince, Rag & Bone, Adidas, Joe's, Marc Jacobs, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. But hurry for first dibs. Get your summer favorites up to 60% off at Nordstrom Rack today. Great brands, great prices. That's why you rack.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.